This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we are still tracing that one high risk contact, the uncle of the boy. He's still evading our contact tracers, but they are really active.
That's Benjamin Sensasi of the World Health Organization on a man who has gone missing in Uganda after possibly being exposed to the Ebola virus. Details next. Also, former Egyptian leader Mohamed Morsi collapsed and died in court today. Boeing has admitted a mistake with a cockpit warning light that didn't work as designed in the 737 MAX jets. And Ethiopia's finance minister says the government is preparing to privatize some state-owned entities. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Uganda's Ministry of Health and the World Health Organization are looking for a possible Ebola case who has vanished. The man is believed to be an uncle to a 5-year-old boy who died of Ebola last week in the Kasese district amid concerns that he could spread the highly contagious disease. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Teams have been instituted to search for the man who crossed from the Democratic Republic of Congo DRC to Uganda with the family of 3 confirmed Ebola cases. While 4 suspected cases from the family were repatriated to DRC, with one of the confirmed cases last week, the whereabouts of one man remain unknown. Benjamin Sensasi is the World Health Organization WHO communications officer in Uganda.
We are still tracing that one high risk contact, the uncle of the boy. He's still evading our contact tracers, but they are really active.
Sensasi says chances are high the suspect could have crossed back to the DRC unnoticed using the porous borders.
Because they do, and it's easy for them to cross over without us noticing, which I think he did. But if he is still within the Ugandan border, he definitely will be found.
Uganda's Ministry of Health says they are in the process of formalizing collaboration with DRC on Ebola to facilitate quick and easy information sharing, as well as health workers exchange. Dr. Jen Ruth Acheng is Uganda's health minister.
We cannot confidently say, even after we do not have any suspects, that we don't have Ebola. So the situation remains guarded, but we support one another and we continue cross-border collaboration. In a few days' time, we shall be signing a memorandum of understanding that allows us, you know, to move freely and to work together. And so we continue to support the DRC.
According to an Ebola situation report from the Ministry of Health, Saturday, about 96 contacts with the confirmed Ebola case are being monitored for any signs and symptoms of Ebola. The ministry notes that these are being monitored in their homes and none has shown any symptoms yet. According to WHO, all close contacts should be monitored for 21 days following their last known exposure to the case and be isolated if they become ill. The WHO Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, visited Uganda over the weekend to assess Uganda's response to the current Ebola outbreak in Kasese. He pledged to mobilize global and regional support for Uganda to ensure that disease is contained. He noted seemingly declining trends in DRC's Butembo and Katwa areas, but emphasized that Mabalako, where the Ugandan cases came from, remains a hotbed for Ebola. By yesterday, one of the 2 suspected cases who had been in isolation at Buera Ebola treatment unit tested negative to Ebola and was discharged, while the other awaits results. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The timing couldn't be more dramatic. Just minutes after declaring he had many secrets that he could reveal, former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi collapsed in court today. The 67-year-old Muslim Brotherhood leader was dead before he could be taken to the hospital. The Associated Press cited a judicial official on the many secrets, quote, adding that Morsi said he wouldn't reveal them because it would hurt Egypt's national security. Morsi was elected president in 2012, but lasted only a year before the military ousted him. He's been in jail since then and was in the midst of a retrial inside Cairo's Toura prison on charges of espionage with the Palestinian Hamas militant group while facing other cases. AP quoted Mohammed Sudan, leading member of the Muslim Brotherhood in London, as describing Morsi's death as premeditated murder, saying he was banned from receiving medicine or visits and there was little information about his health condition. Seeking to restore public confidence after two catastrophic crashes, Boeing has admitted a mistake with a cockpit warning light that didn't work as designed. The system's fault in the airline manufacturer's new 737 MAX jets had been linked to an April crash by Ethiopian Airlines and a Lion Air crash in Indonesia last October. 346 people were killed in the two accidents. The planes have been grounded for 3 months. Boeing hopes to get clearance later this year to get the planes back in the air. Company CEO Dennis Muhlenberg told reporters before the Paris Air Show that restoring trust in the MAX is Boeing's top priority. It's unclear whether either crash could have been prevented if the cockpit alert had been working properly. Boeing's commercial airplanes boss, Kevin McAllister, called the crashes a pivotal moment for the company and a time to make sure accidents like this never happen again. Ethiopia's finance minister says the government is preparing to privatize some state-owned entities. However, the plan to sell off parts of the country's once-guarded crown jewels is getting a mixed reaction. Sarah Kimani reports from Addis Ababa.
At a corner of Ethiopian Airlines complex in Addis Ababa sits a DC-3, a constant reminder of the milestones that Africa's most successful national carrier has made since its first international flight 73 years ago. Now the airline is seeking a partner as part of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's plans to privatize some of the country's state-owned entities. Ethiopia's Finance Minister Ahmed Shide explains.
In the past, we have been actively involved in the economic affairs, but now we are rebalancing. We need to facilitate the sustainability of growth. We will partially privatize four of state-owned enterprises: telecom, aviation, energy, logistics as well.
One of the crown jewels, state monopoly Ethio Telecom, has a customer base of 65 million people. The finance minister says those numbers should be enough to whet any investor's appetite.
The most important initiative is the market potential itself. It's growing, big market potential in many areas. So that is the most important thing. But we are also revising a lot of laws and procedures on customs as part of ease of doing business.
Some companies say the decision to open Ethiopia's markets could not come at a better time. Dario Wilson is the managing director of East African Bottling Share Company, a subsidiary of Coca-Cola.
I think the opening up of the economy will bring a whole lot of additional benefits as well. Like, one of our biggest challenges at the moment is just, you know, access to forex and dollars. I think when it opens up, if it opens up and how it opens up, it will be beneficial to all the players within that operate within Ethiopia.
Not everyone is convinced that privatization is the best path forward. Getacho Alemu, an investments and development consultant based in Addis Ababa, says the country's economic problems will not be solved through privatization.
There are serious concerns about the decision itself and the process by which it's being implemented, the pace of implementing the policy, as well as other related issues like accountability and transparency and the future of these sectors.
He also says there needs to be a regulatory framework in place to ensure that shares of the state-owned enterprises are not sold for less than they are worth. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
15 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Three suicide bombers attacked a hall in northeastern Nigeria where soccer fans were watching a match on TV last night, killing 30 people and injuring 48 others. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion fell on the Boko Haram Islamist group. The attack occurred in Maiduguri, the state capital of Borno State. Officials say one bomber was kept out of the hall by the owner. One bomb went off then, and the other two then detonated their explosives. The Nigerian government says Boko Haram and the rival Islamic State West Africa Province group have been largely defeated, but they continue to launch attacks on civilian and military targets. Security was one of the top issues in Nigeria's recent election. The bombings came 2 days after at least 34 people were killed when an armed gang on motorbikes attacked several villages in Nigeria's northwestern state of Zamfara. The conflict between herders and farmers in the north-central region of Nigeria has left thousands of people dead and rendered many more homeless over the past few years. Gift Agiriga visits Benue State and tells us more on the growing impact of the conflict.
Amnesty International estimates that in 2018, more than 2,000 people in central Nigeria died in conflicts between herders and farmers. The rights group says over 3 years, at least 3,641 deaths have been recorded. About 700 of the deaths have been recorded in Benue State, the most of any state. The violence has displaced thousands of people and led to the creation of emergency camps for internally displaced persons in parts of the state. The Abagana camp shelters more than 2,000 people whose homes have been leveled and crops and businesses ruined. Philip Usate is the chairman of the internally displaced persons in Abagana camp, which is about 2 kilometers north of Makurdi, the Benue State capital. He says life in the camp cannot be compared to life at home.
There is no place like home. Despite the fact that we are receiving some succor from people, there is nothing that you can do us here that will give us everlasting happiness.
James Yoka works for the Benue State Emergency Management Agency and manages their Abagana camp.
The government of Benue State has been seriously trying with them. But you know, there's no way you can satisfy somebody who has been taking care of himself and all of a sudden he has become a burden.
Benue State Governor Samuel Otom has promised that residents of the IDP camps will return to their homes in the next couple of months.
We had 180,000 IDPs that we had in 8 camps in Benue State. We had over 500,000 that were staying with relatives in various places. Most of them are now gradually moving back.
The conflict has grown as Nigerians' population has risen. Increasingly, land where the herding communities for centuries have grazed their cattle has been taken over with urban development and crops. As a result, some herders have let their cattle graze on farmland, angering farmers who say the livestock destroys their crops. The herders allegedly hire armed guards to accompany the cattle, resulting in violent conflicts with farmers. To stop the bloodletting, the Benue State government passed the law to end open grazing, cattle stealing, and to encourage ranching. Otom calls ranching the best way to end the conflict.
Our people were killed, our women were raped, people were displaced from their ancestral homes, properties worth billions of naira destroyed, and no one could find a solution to this. Until I came in 2015, and I said, look, we must find a way, otherwise all of us will be consumed.
However, the herders disagree. Garus Gololo is the spokesperson of the Mieti Allah Cattle Breeders Association in Benue State.
They come and say, we're angry with him. You say, you ban them grazing, and that is the only place they have. I mean, it is against fundamental human rights, even the national law. We need a dialogue. So if they have a signed agreement between them and the farmers and the husband.
In the meantime, Governor Tom says the state's ability to resolve the situation is overstretched, and he calls for interventions from donor agencies and the federal government of Nigeria. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
The Islamist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for bombings that killed at least 18 people in Somalia and Kenya, including 8 Kenyan police near the border between the two countries. Witnesses and medical services say at least 10 people were killed and 23 others injured when a car bomb exploded Saturday on a busy Mogadishu street. Security official Aden Mohammed told VOA's Somali service that the bomb went off close to parliament after its driver ignored warning shots and ran through a security checkpoint. He said surrounding buildings were severely damaged or demolished by the blast, which sent huge plumes of smoke into the air. A roadside bomb the same day hit a vehicle carrying 11 Kenyan police officers, killing 8 and critically injuring 2 others in Wajir district in northeast Kenya. The United States said today it is reopening its permanent U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID mission in Somalia, 28 years after it closed. Although the U.S. never formally severed diplomatic relations with Somalia, the U.S. embassy was closed in 1991 after a long civil war led to the collapse of the country's central government. USAID also announced nearly $185 million in humanitarian assistance for Somalia to help ease life-threatening food insecurity and acute malnutrition, as well as to deliver safe water and emergency health care due to ongoing conflict and prolonged drought. The U.S. is the largest donor of humanitarian assistance to Somalia. The Rwandans have been deported from Uganda, where they claim they were illegally detained and tortured. This happens as bilateral tensions keep heating up since relations soured around 2015. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali, Rwanda.
The Rwandans, including students, evangelists, and taxi motor riders, who say they are lucky to be freed from Ugandan security facilities and deported. Savula Jean-Pierre says he was picked from church. I was sitting with the other Christians. I was sitting at the back of the church. It was in the baptism ceremonies. At around 11:30, I saw a Ugandan military car parking outside of the church. They entered and took me to the car, handcuffed me, asking where are the others. I thought I was going to be killed, but they put me in their detention. They describe how they were tortured in the jail in Mbuye, headquarters of the Chieftaincy of Military Intelligence, CMI. Hadjimana Silas had spent 10 years in Kampala. When they abduct you, they cover your face. You cannot know where you are taken. It comes off when they begin torturing and beating you every morning, forcing you to say that you were a Rwandan spy. They uncovered us today when we were on our way here. Ugandan authorities say the detainees are not ordinary people. It calls them Rwandan spies, but Rwanda's government always dismisses such allegations. Olivier Nduhungirehe is the state minister in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in charge of regional cooperation and East African community affairs. They are innocent. They are good citizens who don't want to join rebel groups that are being recruited in Uganda to destabilize the country. These Rwandans have their families and their properties in Uganda, but the injustice made them lose everything. For us, the problem is that there are still an unknown number of Rwandans jailed in those ungazetted cells. This is another sign of deteriorating bilateral relations. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame said he has talked with his Ugandan counterpart Yoweri Museveni, but talks seem to have hit a deadlock.
We have evidence, and I have discussed it with my counterpart in Uganda. There are meetings we had in Addis Ababa, have a summit. We met twice on 2 days during the summit. Directly, we're talking. I have kept quiet about so many things, but tried to attend, you know, to them, pay attention, do my best, do this, and hoping that the best will come, and it doesn't come.
Apart from being neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda share a very bold history with Rwanda's ruling system. Kagame and other senior military and ruling party officials lived and worked with Museveni. In 1990, when the Rwanda Patriotic Army started a liberation struggle to oust former President Juvenal Habyarimana, many soldiers had high ranks in Ugandan forces. But the problem seemed to wipe out brotherhood deals. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
An attack in central Mali this week that killed at least 35 members of the Dogon ethnic group is generally thought to be a result of ethnic conflict. But as extremist forces continue their hold in the region, the lines between ethnic conflict and extremist violence has become blurred. From Dakar, VOA's Essa Sari has more.
Conflicts between ethnic Dogon, traditionally farmers, and Fulani, or Pol, semi-nomadic herders, have intensified, though the two groups have coexisted for centuries. According to a UN report released last month, clashes between the two ethnic groups in central Mali were exacerbated by the presence of extremist groups. But the cause of recent clashes between the groups is different than those previously seen, says Ali Untine, director of Dakar-based research organization Africa Jam.
C'est-à-dire aujourd'hui, il faut que les forces de sécurité du Mali.
Teen says that today we see a transformation of the conflict, which is becoming more complex as extremists find and exacerbate pre-existing divergences in communities across the Sahel. In 2012, extremists gained ground in northern Mali in a coup, and subsequent peace agreements have failed, leaving parts of the large country without government forces. Instead, local militias have formed to protect their communities. Sunday's attack on the ethnic Dogon village of Sobanda was seen by many as retaliation for an attack in March that left roughly 160 Fulani dead. Malian officials initially said Sunday's attack had killed 95 people, but later said they'd miscalculated by including the number of those missing. The official death toll now stands at 35, although the mayor of the village told Reuters that he believes it's higher. Visiting the site of the attack on Thursday, Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, warned villagers against retaliation and said the government would work to disarm local militias. But Teen says a lack of government forces has left locals without a system to be defended or even be warned of potential upcoming attacks.
Aujourd'hui, c'est une transformation du conflit, c'est-à-dire que le conflit se complexifie.
Teen says that the government security forces, as well as United Nations forces, must work to replace militias and assure the security of people in central Mali. Though Sunday's attack was between specific groups in Mali, the conflict is reflective of similar problems throughout the region. Burkina Faso and Niger are among countries that have seen an increase in similar attacks, a growing problem that analysts like Teen argue can only be solved with structural changes. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Dakar.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.